William Sanders versus Betty Cotton.
Please, the court. My name is Eric Snapp, counsel for William Sanders. Mr. Sanders' conviction and the Indiana Court of Appeals' decision on post-conviction relief is contrary to clearly established principles of federal constitutional law, and habeas relief is required in this case. Mr. Sanders was convicted of murder and attempted murder. The jury, however, was never instructed that the state was required to prove the absence of sudden heat to gain such a conviction. Instead, the jury was instructed that the state must prove the presence of sudden heat for Mr. Sanders to receive a conviction, to be convicted of the lesser offenses of voluntary manslaughter and attempted voluntary manslaughter. These errors so infected Mr. Sanders' trial that his conviction violates due process. Further, Mr. Sanders' counsel on direct appeal is constitutionally ineffective for failing to raise these instructional errors. The Indiana Court of Appeals' rejection of that ineffective assistance claim was also contrary to established federal constitutional law. In fact, the Court of Appeals did not even apply the Strickland standard to the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel issue. I'll begin with the due process issues. Of course, the question on habeas review of a jury instruction is whether the ailing instruction so infected the trial that the resulting conviction violates due process. That is the case here. The Indiana Court of Appeals didn't even reach that question. It applied a rule completely different from the governing law set forth in the Supreme Court jurisprudence. And its decision is therefore contrary to clearly established federal law. In fact, with regard to Mr. Sanders' proffered instruction, which would have required the jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt the absence of sudden heat to convict of murder and attempted murder, the Indiana Court of Appeals simply concluded that the trial court did not abuse its discretion by refusing that instruction. Now, the Due Process Clause protects a criminal defendant against any conviction except proof beyond a reasonable doubt of every fact that's required to constitute that crime. And that's the Winship case, of course. Of course, the jury must also be properly instructed as to those facts and the elements. And this court has explained that when the jury isn't told that an element forms a necessary part of the crime, the matter is actually taken out of the hands of the jury entirely, and essentially there's a directed verdict against the defendant. Here, under Indiana law, once there's any appreciable evidence of sudden heat in the record, the state was required to prove the absence of sudden heat in order to convict Mr. Sanders of murder and attempted murder. If it couldn't prove the absence of sudden heat, then the most that Mr. Sanders could be convicted of was voluntary manslaughter and attempted voluntary manslaughter. Now, the trial court, Mr. Sanders proffered an instruction that would have told the jury that it had to find the absence of sudden heat beyond a reasonable doubt. The trial court refused Mr. Sanders' request to instruct the jury in that way. Instead of instructing the jury that the state had to prove the absence of sudden heat, trial court actually instructed the jury that the state had to prove the presence of sudden heat to prove voluntary manslaughter or attempted voluntary manslaughter. Under the court's instructions, the jury was prohibited from returning a voluntary manslaughter conviction unless the state proved the presence of sudden heat beyond a reasonable doubt. Obviously, the state was never inclined to put in such proof. It was trying to gain a conviction of murder, an attempted murder and had no incentive whatsoever to prove the presence of sudden heat. That said, the record contained evidence of sudden heat, and the trial court concluded that it was appropriate to instruct the jury as to voluntary manslaughter and attempted voluntary manslaughter. But the jury, given the instructions that it was told about, the jury could not have concluded that the state had actually proven the absence of sudden heat. So it was never instructed to do so.
What about this mitigation argument that your opponents make concerning the fact that that was wrong in the jury instructions?
That the
it's harmless error, and it also went to mitigation, and sort of a suggestion that it was properly used, it could be considered for mitigation.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the respondent didn't raise harmless error before the trial court, before the district court, and therefore waived any harmless error argument. But even if this court decided to evaluate the harmless error argument, this error was simply not harmless. The jury could not possibly have concluded that the state had proven the absence of sudden heat. There's just no way that the jury was instructed that the state had to prove the presence of sudden heat. It's the fact that it was a mitigating circumstance, as articulated in the instructions, does not cure the defect. And frankly, the jury couldn't possibly have determined anything with regard to the state's proof as to the absence of sudden heat. The state actually also argues that Mr. Sanders isn't entitled to instructions in the first place, and that's really the basis of the respondent's argument on harmless error. And the respondent is simply mistaken on that. There's a very low standard under Indiana law for the giving of such instructions. There just has to be any appreciable evidence in the record of sudden heat. And the trial court here must have evaluated the evidence and found that there was appreciable evidence of sudden heat. The trial court gave the instructions. And further, if the court looks at the record, particularly the evidence that I've outlined at pages 7 through 9 of the reply brief and page 18 of the opening brief, the record contains ample evidence of sudden heat. So the respondent's argument that Mr. Sanders wasn't entitled to the instructions in the first place and therefore the errors were harmless is simply mistaken. Now, the jury, as I stated earlier, could not have concluded that the state had proven the absence of sudden heat because it was never instructed to do so. In fact, the jury might have actually concluded that sudden heat was proven by a preponderance of the evidence, but that it wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore Mr. Sanders was not eligible for a voluntary manslaughter or attempted voluntary manslaughter conviction in lieu of murder and attempted murder. Now that the Indiana court's rejection of Mr. Sanders' instructional claims therefore constitutes an unreasonable application of the Supreme Court's clearly established due process law, and habeas relief is required. Quickly, with respect to the ineffective assistance claim, clearly the issues raised on direct appeal were not as strong. The issue that was not raised actually was both obvious and clearly stronger than the consecutive sentencing claim raised by appellate counsel on direct appeal, and there certainly was a reasonable probability, given Harrington v. State, an Indiana Supreme Court case, that had these issues been raised on direct appeal, the outcome of Mr. Sanders' appeal would have been different. Thank you.
Please.
May it please the court. Another fact and different evidence at trial this case might present an interesting question of effective assistance of appellate counsel on habeas review. However, the facts that are contained in this record and the evidence that was presented at trial do not present an interesting case at all. Appellate counsel was not ineffective for failing to challenge the trial court's instructions, and appellate counsel was similarly not ineffective for failing to raise the issue of the trial court's refusal of the tendered instruction that was offered to supplement the trial court's instruction on sudden heat. This is true because under Indiana law, a reversal will not result from a trial court's refusal to give an instruction unless there is a likelihood that it would affect the result. Therefore, this claim would be a non-starter on direct appeal, and Judge Sharp correctly made that conclusion when he considered the claim on habeas review. The problem here with the claim is that Indiana's sudden heat doctrine requires evidence of a provocation, and that provocation has to be sufficient to cause an ordinary person to lose their ability to coolly reflect on their circumstances. And the record here is just abjectly devoid of any significant, credible evidence. Counsel for petitioner mentions that the trial court did give voluntary manslaughter instructions. And that is true, and the record does not reveal specifically what his basis was for doing that, but counsel is correct that Indiana law says that appreciable evidence warrants the giving of the instruction.
What was the position of the government at trial?
On the instruction, Your Honor?
Yes. Did you object to the giving of the instruction on voluntary manslaughter?
I don't think there was an objection. I'm not certain of that, Your Honor, but I don't believe there was. And Your Honor, there is arguably appreciable evidence which would, at a bare minimum, warrant giving the instruction, and that is this. The victim, not the victim that deceased, not the child, but the former girlfriend, the mother of the child, was riding with the petitioner, and petitioner's testimony was that as they argued while driving in the car, that, and this is his testimony, not quite verbatim, but I think faithful. He says to Sharon, who is the ex-girlfriend, it ain't, and I think he was referring to the relationship, that's clear from the testimony, gonna work to her. And his testimony is then, and the next thing I know, my son is going out the window. That, were it true, would certainly be provocation. But the fact of the matter is, that is the only shred of evidence that would support this. Because in Indiana law, sudden heat can't be supported by mere anger, mere words. It has to be a provocation that rises above and beyond that. Certainly, were this woman to have thrown her son and petitioner's son out the window of a moving car, that would suffice. However, the testimony is unexplained, incredible, in the context of numerous other inconsistencies in petitioner's testimony. And I think that something that really illustrates...
Is it physically impossible?
Physically impossible. Your Honor, there are some discrepancies in the testimony that would suggest that it was improbable. Testimony the petitioner gave about rolling up and rolling down a window during the course of the conversation, but I don't think that an interpretation of the evidence would
preclude. We do have case law that says if it's not physically impossible, then it's a jury question. Why isn't this a jury question? And why wasn't it just simply submitted to the jury to decide whether or not that happened or not?
Your Honor, it was a jury question. That finding of fact, whether
it
happened...
Well, it was a jury question, then it had to be submitted under appropriate instructions, right? I mean, if you're going to submit any issue of fact to the jury, it's got to be under appropriate instructions.
And, Your Honor, we do not contend before this court that the trial court's instruction on voluntary manslaughter was correct. We are just contending that, given this error, it still has to be shown in the context of the evidence and in the case considered in total that there would have been a likelihood of an effect on the verdict from the erroneous instruction. And here, we think that this court's resort to the record will show conclusively that there was not even a realistic possibility, let alone any kind of probability, that had this jury been instructed that the state's obligation was to prove or to negate, I think most of the case law refers to it as negating the element of sudden heat beyond reasonable doubt.
Well,
but that would have achieved any difference.
But he testified that Pratchett threw the son out of the window and he began hitting her, and that's not what he doesn't remember much after that. And then the evidence is that he turned the car around, crossed over the lane, and hit them both with the car. If the jury believed his statement, his testimony, then we would have had a different outcome. Tell us, what are the things that, and you mentioned them in your brief, but I'd like you to highlight, what are the things that are contrary to that? Because I'm still having trouble with, if it's a question of fact for the jury, I don't understand why the instruction wasn't given.
And again, Your Honor, we are not contending. We are not contending that the trial court in giving the instruction should have given a correct instruction. But the evidence would not have allowed, even had the correct instruction been given,
a
different
result. And I'm asking you to
result.
Tell me why the evidence.
I understand, Your Honor.
Specifically,
I will try to speak to that. I think it's clear from the record. Mr. Sanders then explains, and you mentioned the fact that he was asked about beating Sharon. He denied beating Sharon, even though there was blood evidence found all over the inside of the car. Then he talked about blackouts throughout his testimony, which is really his only defense, is his own testimony. And he gives the self-serving statement that, when asked about the hitting or the abuse of Sharon, that he didn't remember that. He remembered grabbing her by the shoulder, and he shook her. And after that, he couldn't remember anything. And in fact, he testified affirmatively that the very next thing he remembered was sitting in his lawyer's office discussing the prospect of turning himself into authorities. This goes along with his equivocation about his blackouts. His defense was essentially to offer oblique, unsupported invitations to find affirmative defenses without supporting them, and he didn't support any of them. Well, I don't think that this is trial counsel's fault, because I don't think that he had a persuasive, supported argument.
Well, he did testify that he became jealous of her during this hospital waiting room situation, right?
Yes, that's right. Well, no, actually, Your Honor, that was Sharon's testimony. He did not admit to that in his own testimony. He said that... From what I could glean.
Well, you're right. That was her testimony. His testimony was that they had this argument and she was going to leave, and that's what he was reacting to. He did say that in front of the jury.
Yes, I believe he told her that he was going
right.
to leave. Yes.
And it and during the argument, he insisted on taking the son, and that's the point where he says she threw the son out the window.
Frankly, Your Honor, and I'm not saying you're wrong, I do not recall the part about him telling her that he insisted upon taking his son. That may be part of the testimony there. I'm not certain of that. However, that still would not constitute the things that led up to his allegation that she pitched the child from the window would in no way, shape, or form satisfy Indiana's requirement that sudden heat be shown. And I wanted to also get back to these blackout excuses, I'd call them, that were offered by the petitioner at trial. He didn't even conclusively state that the blackouts were caused by alcohol, although he said, yes, they happen every time I drink. But he did maintain that they always happened when he was in a rage. He'd get so frustrated that he couldn't remember. Apparently, he can't remember so long that he's in his lawyer's office discussing turning himself in before his reason returns to him so that he can remember his circumstances. This is also coupled with evidence that he offered himself and the state presented that show that he had a history of uncontrollable anger and an inability to control his angry impulses. And this is also very relevant because Indiana requires that an ordinary person would be relieved, basically, of their senses by the sudden heat, by the provocation. Not someone who is prone to it and basically is an outlier in regards to how a person would react to provocation. But again, absent this incredible testimony about the baby out the window, there is no evidence of provocation. I think that this whole thing turns on the prejudice prong of the standard for showing ineffective assistance of counsel. I'm sorry, I see that my time has expired. The district court, we believe, correctly determined that appellate counsel did not prejudice petitioner by failing to raise his claim and was not deficient in that respect either.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You've got 1 minute, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Continues.
Good on those last points.
Pardon me?
Yes, those last points he made. Respond to those because you don't have much time.
With regard to the harmless error?
Yes, Your Honor. And the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. Respondent continues to focus on harmless error, and respondent is essentially asking the court to reweigh the evidence and to look beyond the clear conclusion of the trial court that there was sufficient evidence of sudden heat to instruct the jury on voluntary manslaughter and attempted voluntary manslaughter. Now, this court, in evaluating the harmlessness of this error, of course, needs to keep in mind that the standard is whether the record as a whole shows that the error had a substantial and injurious effect or influence in determining the jury's verdict. And this is important. The Supreme Court has stated that if the matter is so evenly balanced, which is at most what the respondent can argue, then the court should treat the error not as if it was harmless, but as if it affected the verdict. That is certainly the case here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. We will proceed to case.